Hello and welcome to a special edition of Media Talk, recorded for the first time with a live audience in the bowels of Guardian HQ. Coming up on this week's podcast, the finest digital media minds will share their views on journalism in the 21st century. Will there be any newspapers left in 5 years' time? Is the age of the free internet over? And why has Twitter taken over the world? You'll hear America's self-styled travelling geeks, J.D. Lassica, Sarah Lacey and Robert Scoble, as well as our own Emily Bell and the BBC's Rory Catherine-Jones. Expect jargon, wonkery and the odd acronym or three. I'm Matt Wells and this is Media Talk, live-ish from The Guardian. You're very kind. Well, after 3 years of podding from the confines of a soundproof room, we thought it was high time to get down and quite possibly dirty with you, our listeners. It's not quite an outside broadcast. We've only moved down a single flight of stairs in the Guardian's King's Place offices, but we are here live in front of about 100 of our most loyal media talkers, what an attractive bunch they are. Let's do a quick straw poll. Speak up if you have come from outside London.
Yes.
Apart from the people from America, has anyone come further afield than North London? Is anyone here not from Islington?
No, somebody over there.
We have encouraged an audience, in fairness, not to actually listen outside London, as it's often pointed out.
Absolutely.
Regional.
No matter how far you've travelled to be here in the audience, all the efforts you've made to find us online, you've made the journey to hear from our esteemed panel and their thoughts on all things digital. Because as we sit here in summer 2009, in the midst of the worst economic crisis for a generation and the biggest ad downturn in history, it's crunch time everywhere. And while it's never been easier to obtain and share information, traditional media are struggling to adapt to the digital age. The TV industry is playing catch-up to YouTube, and as you'll have heard in last week's podcast, the radio sector is even more stuck in the dark ages. Many of the most esteemed daily titles in America teeter on the edge of oblivion. Some have already gone under. And around 20,000 journalists have lost their jobs in the last 18 months. Here in the UK, local papers are closing on an almost weekly basis. And with budgets being squeezed and circulation dwindling, is it only a matter of time before one of our national titles ceases production? So, where do we go from here? Do we still need newspapers to serve as the middlemen, mediators, and interpreters of world events in this digital age? Sarah Lacey, I want to come to you first. You spent the better part of a decade reporting on Silicon Valley, haven't you? The UK media industry is far from healthy, but at least it's not as bad as it is in the United States. How bad is it? Tell us.
We're happy to be even worse off to make you guys feel better. I think everyone thought a couple years ago, okay, maybe some newspapers are going to go under. Whereas, you know, before that, everyone's like, oh, no, we'll just have more media. And then it got to, okay, some will go under, but the New York Times, the Journal, Washington Post, LA Times, those guys will be fine. I mean, now you actually have bankruptcies and closures, and you have papers for sale that there are frankly no buyers for. And when you even have the New York Times and it's quarter over quarter, you know, its advertising numbers are off 30-40%. Yeah, that's not a factor of the downturn. I mean, this is an industry that's dramatically...
The Boston Globe looking as if it might actually go under.
Yeah. And a lot of some of the papers in the Pacific Northwest and Denver and some other cities. We could have 10 major metropolitan cities by the end of the year that no longer have a major daily paper, which I don't think anyone thought would happen this fast.
So why has this happened then? Robert Scoble, you're a blogger, video producer, an all-round technological evangelist. Is it a crisis that's being driven by technology?
Yes, it is. The advertising dollars have gone from paper. The San Jose Mercury News, the paper I grew up with, used to have a substantial amount of its revenues on classified advertising. And that kind of advertising has moved completely online, thanks to Craigslist. Craig Newmark is here
in the audience.
We'll come to him later.
So we can blame it all on
him.
We can blame the whole thing on Craig. You know? But a lot of that advertising has moved online. You're seeing other kinds of advertising move online. Certainly right now we're seeing advertisers now are figuring out that online you can study the person who's looking at the ad much deeper than you can with a full page in the newspaper.
And it's also because of technological advances, giving the users, the people formerly known as the readers, the opportunity to participate in journalism as well. I mean, we're recording this on July the 7th, four years ago on this day, not a few hundred yards from here, there was the terrible event of the July 7th bombings in London, a story that was told through cameras on mobile phones. Yeah. And it's all come from there, hasn't it?
I think people forget. We focus on the advertising issue so much, we forget that a lot of this is actually subscribers leaving these print publications because they're going and they're interacting more with media and they are, choosing maybe to read it on a Kindle where they are not getting ink on their fingers and having to turn pages. Maybe they're, interacting and, listening to a podcast or listening to a blog. So as much as what Robert's saying is absolutely right with the advertisers and their ability to better digest, the papers are losing their audience as well. So
J.D. Lassica, you're a social media specialist. I mean, technology can only be responsible for so much, can't it? I mean, isn't this more to do with, or at least as much to do with the changing desires of and behaviors of audiences and
consumers?
Oh, absolutely,
yeah. And where I'm coming from, and I don't mean San Francisco, is the fact that I used to work for newspapers for 20 years, and I was a major daily newspaper in California for 11 years. So it's with some sadness that I report that the state of the news industry is not good. And it's not just technology. It's also a matter of changing culture, of changing media habits. Young people in particular, I don't know if I know a single person under 25 who reads a newspaper anymore. So that does not bode well over the long run.
I don't think I know a person under 35 that reads a newspaper anymore.
Yeah. Emily, you've been a doom-monger for the newspaper industry on several occasions, mostly on this podcast. But things must be pretty bad when of all newspapers, the Washington Post has to pimp itself out in the way that we've seen in the last week. To tell us about that, and why do you think that happened?
Yes, I mean, this is for people in the UK. They might not be so familiar with the story of the Washington Post and its Salon project, which is it has a publisher called Catherine Weymouth, who was going to hold a $25,000 per place dinner, or $250,000 if you want to sponsor the whole thing, sort of get together at her home in order to talk about, I think, healthcare reform was the issue on the agenda.
So you'd have journalists from the Washington Post.
So you'd have journalists, and you'd also have CEOs, and you'd have lobbyists, and so you're effectively kind of becoming a meeting place, if you like, a kind of a real-life iteration of what a sort of a newspaper is, it's kind of an opinion forming thing.
It's not a bad idea.
And you charge access for it. Well, I was going to say, one of the kind of issues about this is, it's not a bad idea unless it kind of gets out there in a really unfortunate way and you haven't really thought about the PR ahead of time, because I think that there are organisations that are media organisations that, not this one, but that convene very similar things and have made money out of it for years and years.
We're missing a trick audience to come
on. Exactly, I was going to say. Yes, that's right. The 25p ahead that they boxed at. Micropayment, exactly. 99p to attend. So you could, on the one hand, it just looked astonishingly awful, not least because, as somebody pointed out, that there was nobody who was chronically sick actually invited. So first of all, it was a kind of very blatant, badly handled way of kind of PRing what's actually, hats off to the Washington Post, can't believe I quite said that, that they were actually looking at new revenue models. And, that's the key thing, which is that actually kind of some of what's been said before is absolutely right. And if you were being brutal to the newspaper industry, and I'm allowed to be because I work in it, is that perhaps for years and years and years we didn't listen closely enough to our audiences and what they wanted, that actually there's a kind of, that any industry, when it occupies a monopoly position in terms of distribution, becomes a little bit inwardly focused. And I think we all looked at each other and we all kind of, used the same metrics. We never actually said, well, hang on a second, what do people really, really want? And I think that, Google always say the reason we did so well and you guys did so badly is because we understood what advertisers really, really wanted, and you were unable, you weren't thinking about that. You were more thinking about your relationship with the agencies and not about the actual kind of people who were advertising.
So things are bad in America. We've established that. Rory Catlin-Jones is the BBC's technology correspondent. Does the presence of the corporation in the UK mean that journalism has actually got unusually a secure future in Britain because of the strength of the BBC publicly funded, or does it mean that other voices are going to be crushed out and snuffed out?
Well, I feel incredibly privileged here tonight, and also incredibly old media. I'm the only person on the panel I notice wearing a tie.
Well, that's good. He's been to Buckingham Palace.
I have to confess, I was touched by the Queen. I tweeted earlier that I was going to have tea with the Queen, and then I was going to meet Robert Scoble. And a lot of people came back and said, "You're meeting Robert Scoble." Touching for me. So it's been an incredibly mixture of old and new media this afternoon. Yes, I do feel incredibly privileged. I've been inside an organisation for more than 25 years, which has a guaranteed income, which has just about managed to keep dancing with the changing pattern of journalism, keep reinventing itself, force me to reinvent myself. I've spent most of my career as a television journalist serving big audiences on lunchtime news bulletins and having very little engagement with the audience. I've got a much more rewarding job now doing serving audiences online, on radio, on TV at the same time, and having far more engagement through all these social networking tools. But I give talks from time to time to students, and I feel really bad for them, journalism students, who say, you know, what's it looking like out there? And you don't quite know how to break it to them. Yeah. What impresses me is that there's a whole new generation of journalists coming out of universities who've got three times as many skills as I ever had getting into this profession. People are learning to adapt very fast, I think. I'm meeting 20-something journalists who can all blog, create a website, shoot video, do audio, and write a bit. I think they need sometimes to concentrate on one skill, but I think those skills are coming through.
All right, we can come back to that later. At the time of recording, Michael Jackson's funeral is taking place in Los Angeles. It's expected to be one of the biggest online events of the year as people stream, blog, and tweet, about which, by the way, more later. But as the madness goes on in LA, it's worth reminding ourselves how the mainstream media handled the breaking news of his death a fortnight ago. This is how it played out on BBC Radio 5 Live.
A moment ago I said the Los Angeles Times were reporting that Michael Jackson was in a coma. The Los Angeles Times are now reporting that Michael Jackson is dead. So that's now from the Los Angeles... We had it from TMZ, a website, which, although a reputable website, meant that we were unsure and to some extent nervous about reporting that. But it's now coming from several sources. The Hollywood Reporter are saying that he has died, and right now the Los Angeles Times are also saying that Michael Jackson has died.
Richard Bacon confirming the news that the King of Pop had died almost an hour after it was broken, quote, on a website. It's worth pointing out, of course, that TMZ, which the website in question is owned by that minnow Time Warner. Sarah Lacey, what did you make of that when you heard it? Does that demonstrate that there's still quite a gap in understanding? You know, it's fine. The BBC now confirms it now that the LA Times has said it, but they wouldn't believe it when a mere website had reported it. It's still quite interesting.
Well, I mean, you know, TMZ does not exactly have the most sterling reputation for journalism. So I think, actually, probably I showed my old school journalism roots a little bit by sort of blanching that they were the ones who actually had the story right, and CNN and quite a few others got it wrong. But I think what that confirmed to me is just there's so much volatility in our profession right now as everyone is trying to grapple with getting a piece of what's new or hang on to what's old and decaying, that for me, I just think it's almost a grab bag, and it's like a game of boggle. It's all been thrown up in the air, and TMZ is just as likely to be right as CNN these days. And as a consumer of news, as someone who writes news, I think that's sort of concerning. As a consumer of news, though, in some ways it's good because you're getting a lot more information, but you just have to probably bring the same rigor to it that we probably always should have been bringing to the media before. So, you know, the internet's doing what the internet does. It's eliminating the gatekeepers, and it is really just becoming a free-for-all where it could be just as right hearing it, reading it on Twitter, as, you know, that could have more credibility than, you know, the New York Times.
A better story, actually, is the Iran protest, the Iranian election protest. CNN, on that first Saturday, I kept turning on CNN because my wife is Iranian, and we wanted to hear the news about what was going on. We had already seen some videos and some pictures and some reports on Twitter about the protest, and I turn on CNN, and they had Larry King live with two motorcycle mechanics. And I started Twittering about that, and so did other people. In fact, that night, the hashtag was CNN fail, yeah. because they were not reporting the news. They were doing, you know, garbagey, feature. You know, feature stories that are cheap. Their news crew was, you know, it was a Saturday. They were all at the beach, you know.
J.D. Lasker, well, what do you make? I mean, we'll talk about Iran and Twitter and all that in more detail in a bit. But what about Michael Jackson? I thought it was interesting.
You mentioned media people. Always come back.
I'm a quality journalist.
What I was interested in is that once the mainstream media realized that this was a big story and it was true and that a lot of people were talking about it, they pounced on it and they rolled with it for days and days and days. And actually, if you looked at Twitter trends,
yes.
The internet had moved on.
Well, MJ's was there for at least a week, so... Yeah. I don't think it's something you can blame on the mainstream media. I think, Sarah's right. We're all the media now, right? So you have to, there's a special onus on us as individuals now, as news consumers, to make some distinctions and to figure out, you know, the New York Times isn't always right, or CNN, or any other publication, or even TMZ, but I think we all sort of create our own sort of levels of credibility over time as news outlets, and it's up to us as individuals to sort of have this kind of BS detector, or as Howard said last night, you know, crap detectors. It's an old term that Ernest Hemingway came up with, it's just important for that kind of media literacy to sort of sink in with the general public.
Rory.
Yeah, but I think organizations like the BBC can hang on to their kind of their brand by not necessarily being first on that kind of story.
Right.
I'd have been somewhat shocked if we'd let in the moment TMZ broke that news. Mm. And there's an old tradition on, particularly on the BBC World Service, of always waiting for two agencies.
Two sources.
Two sources before confirming. And I think for our consumers, for our audiences too, that is one of the things that differentiates us. In a world where there are so many multiple sources of news, it's not a bad brand to have to be the one that is a bit more careful.
Emily, is that important?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I had a reputation for saying never wrong for long on the web, which is true. Actually, that's the other thing, which is if you do the whole, transatlantic colleague Jeff Jarvis would say, you know, tell them what you know now, and that's all you know now. And actually, that there is something about web news which is conversational and it's not finished, you know, kind of everything that goes in the paper is about a single point of publication, bang, you press the button, it never changes, you know, literally never changes. You can't do anything once it's gone, which is why you put kind of whatever it is, six layers of protection or something around the production process. And actually, you know, that's a great opportunity for old media organisations and the new media. And the other thing that's controversial, I would controversially say this because the Telegraph have recently proved the value of exclusives through the MP's expenses exercise. But actually, kind of exclusivity is a sort of a diminishing commodity that has a diminishing commodity value simply because of the nature of how quickly stories can get out there. I mean, it's kind of, you know, that actually it's people can, certainly sort of news organisations can create experiences and communities around news events without actually owning the event or owning the fact that it's happened. Very few news organisations, Rory's is one, but actually live in the kind of tiny bit of the kind of the sort of the centre of the story. There are only kind of maybe sort of three or four organisations that genuinely live where breaking news is. And for the rest of us, it's all about kind of context and meeting place and whether or not you can kind of actually have the best conversation around that, whether you can add the best value to it, or you have the best analysis of it, etc., etc.
All right, we can come on to more on that in a moment.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Let's move on to look at how journalism has changed, and in particular, how it's been influenced by developments in social media.
Let's go first to the Twitter board if we possibly can.
Do you Twitter?
On my Twitter page.
You're talking about Twitter.
Keep Twittering us.
I'll be tweeting through the program.
Time to go between the tweets.
You're a tweet, they're a tweet. Twittering and tweeting.
We have a tweet on Twitter. Tweet, Twitter.
Tweet.
Chirping.
Twitter time.
that's actually, of course, a clip from the excellent Daily Show on Comedy Central. By the way, we'll come on to copyright in the digital age a little later on. Now, while there's no doubting that newspapers may be on their last legs, Twitter has been the media's success story of 2009. Forget the inane ramblings of Ashton Kutcher and Lindsay Lohan, whoever they are. Perhaps one of the biggest surprises of the microblogging site has been how useful it's been in news reporting and how quickly it's been adapted and adopted by the mainstream media. With the likes of the BBC, and we've just heard CNN shut out of Iran and restricted in China, many reports about the violence in both countries recently have been founded and found on tweets and Facebook. Emily, what about this new interaction between mainstream news organisations and, you know, citizen journalists or just ordinary people, as you know, as perhaps we should call them? I don't know.
Yeah, just ordinary people.
Yeah. Sorry.
Or maybe not call them that.
Eyewitnesses to history.
I mean, you know, the interesting thing about Twitter is that it's actually a tool which journalists can use. And by that I mean most journalists can use, that the barrier to entry of technological knowledge has dropped to, you know, an SMS message. And what it does mean is that you are now, as I say, you're actually kind of, it's a very visible way that the barriers have come down. So kind of actually kind of understand it. For journalists, the key thing you have to understand is that your audience are not going to come to you anymore, that you have to go to where they are. And where they mostly are is spending time speaking to each other and their communities of interest, not on your website. If you can get them back to your website, then great. But if you can't, then, you know, go and talk to them where they are. So I think, so from that point of view, that, you know, it sounds very simple. In my experience, it's been quite hard to get journalists to mentally cross that Rubicon. But I think once they have done, and the great thing about Twitter is it's really easy for them to do it, they suddenly sort of notice that you have a different type of following, a different type of audience. Now, look, it does, of course, create attention deficit disorder.
I'm actually
reading bloody Twitter feeds.
I'm actually reading, our Twitter form. There's one very interesting one that's now just fallen down a bit. But what the audience member was asking, why are we making a distinction? I think I made the distinction between blogger media and old media. It's all just media.
Well, it isn't, is it?
It isn't.
I make the distinction not between newspaper and blogger, but between media that has an editor role, and a media that has no editor, no gatekeeper. In other words, I'm in the new media that I can talk directly to my audience. And when I worked for magazines, I had an editor that I had to convince to get that story out. And the editor had to fact check me and make sure everything I was writing was accurate.
I'm
unfiltered, and I can make mistakes. And I can use the audience to help build the story, which is totally different than the old paper media that I used to write.
Sarah Lacey.
Yeah, and I don't think of it so much in terms of what the actual medium is. I mean, I do a column for Business Week. I also write for TechCrunch. I also host a show for Yahoo. So I'm sort of on all of the above.
And do you do all those things in different ways?
Yes,
you adopt
and I do. And then I also am writing a book, which is like the oldest, studiest kind of old media. But it is. I think it goes back to what Emily was saying about, you know, process-based journalism versus, you know, spending a year of your life pouring into one thing that is going to come out and only come out. And I think it's more mentality than it is. And certain things require something. I mean, one reason I still do a column for Business Week is because I actually love having an editor for part of my life. I mean, he makes me a better writer. He does fact check things. He does question me. He does hold me accountable and make me think of a story in a different way. But I also love being able to blog on TechCrunch and not have an editor and be able to be results driven. And I write very different stories for both of them.
JD Lasker, do you think that it is an enriching tool, these, you know, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, and if they're used in the right way, as we've seen in Iran and in China and in lots of other stories, it can bring a whole new aspect to your journalism.
Oh, yeah, we're finally starting to see it. What's kind of disappointing is how long it's taking. 10, 15 years ago, the battle was, should newspapers have websites, because it was going to cannibalize, you know, the print product. Five, 6 years ago, the battle was over, you know, should news organizations have bloggers, because, you know, that's not really journalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually they caught on, so they were about 5 years behind the times. So now the same battle is going on with social media. Should news organizations, should journalists get on these social networks? Should reporters Twitter? Should they be on Facebook? And they're finally, in the past 6 months, sort of coming around.
Yeah.
And they're doing some interesting things. During the 2008 presidential election in the U.S., NPR and Tech President set up this site that let users Twitter and send in SMS messages and phone in on what it was called Live Vote Report, and it was about what was happening at the polling stations in real time around the country. And that was a really good example of how journalism can be used, social media can be used for public service journalism.
Emily, earlier in the year, The Guardian ran an April Fool's story saying it would launch a Twitter version of the paper. I didn't think that was an April Fool.
I was working on it at the time.
But it's not a million miles from the truth, is it?
It's not a million miles from the truth, no. We are the most Twittered and Twittering of UK newspapers.
It's also
even world newspapers.
I'm intensely distracted by our Twitter form behind you. And the media discussion from the Brits is so 2005, apparently, we're being accused of. And I've also been accused of being self-indulgent media. I wish.
Have you seen our phone boxes? You know, are you surprised?
Is this the first Media Talk Live going to be all about journalism? A bit self-indulgent? Yes. Okay. There's the door. We'll leave that there. If you want to follow me, I'm Matthew Wells on Twitter.
I doubt it after that, frankly.
And Emily is Emily Bell. You've got the looks, I've got the brains, let's make lots of money. Well, if only business was as simple as that Pet Shop Boys lyric. We're more than a decade into the internet revolution. Subscription models have come and gone, but no one has yet found a way to monetize content on the web. But as we reported on Media Talk earlier in the spring, Rupert Murdoch thinks he's got the solution. For the dirty digger, the end of free is not only nigh, but nigh on essential. A number of ideas are being investigated by his crack troops, we learn, perhaps one of the most interesting of which, according to a column by James Silver in The Guardian this week, is a tiered subscription platform, a bit like that used for Sky TV, where, say, you might pay for football coverage, and pay a bit more for showbiz news, and pay perhaps quite a lot for page three stunners. The News Corporation chairman doesn't often get it wrong, but Robert Scoble, what do you think about this? Can the free genie be put back into the bottle?
I don't think so. I think news journalism today is commoditized, particularly when you watch Twitter, and Twitter is getting it faster than CNN. I knew about the Chinese earthquake 45 minutes before anybody in the United States reported any, you know, media. CNN was 45 minutes later. You're not going to be able to charge for that kind of news. And if somebody tries charging for that kind
of
news...
But Rupert Murdoch seems to think that you can.
Yeah, well, he can try.
Well,
because
there's the distinction between immediacy and quality. I mean, that's what you were talking about before. You know, I think you're absolutely right when it comes to immediacy. And I think the problem is you can do it with quality, but it's got to be really good and really consistently good, because there's so much even free, really good quality.
And even then, I think you're only going to be able to charge for certain kinds of journalism, you know, financial news. I will pay for the Wall Street Journal, right? Because if I'm trading stocks, I want really accurate information, and I want really in-depth information that somebody really dug and got me the truth about a company. I'm not sure I'm going to pay for that for political news, for instance, because political news is going to be given to a large group of people all at the same time.
Rory Kevin-Jones.
We're seeing exactly the same thing happening, obviously, in the music industry with models like Spotify giving people both free and what's increasingly described as freemium in a slightly bizarre way, options. And the problem at the moment is that free is a very easy sell, and freemium, £10 a month for something a bit better, there doesn't seem to be that demand. It's quite difficult to find the products that are of the quality and exclusivity that people will actually pay for. Yes, financial news, some financial news.
You're snorting, Emily.
I'm not snorting. I completely agree with what everybody said. I just think they're being incredibly polite. I mean, you know, I do feel as I'm trapped.
Let it all out.
Groundhog Day. I cannot believe. Where were these people in 2002 when we had this conversation? And what you couldn't charge for content, and people stopped charging for content. Nothing has changed except there is now more online, which is free. So if you're kind of, you know, the more time Rupert Murdoch spends investigating tiered subscription layers for The Times, Sunday Times, News of the World, etc., hooray, frankly. I think that every minute you spend thinking about an old model which won't work and not thinking about new models which might work is another minute that you can tick off the live clock of your media organisation. I just think that it's sort of dangerously delusional. You know, we're not the record industry, we're not the books industry, we're not the film industry. We don't have reusable content. We really don't have reusable content. It's real-time content, financial news, which you can charge for at the moment. But don't forget, before the ad crash, Murdoch was about to take the paywall off the Wall Street Journal. Don't forget, the Financial Times took the paywall off, you know, 60% of its content. It's not like this is kind of the arguments have changed.
So no discussions within the Guardian at all about charging for anything?
No, well, you know, not on those terms. I think, you know, we do know that actually if you want to reach an audience, the worst thing you can do is put now, people will pay for utility. I think the apps market is a really interesting one. I think that kind of, you know, when people go, oh, iTunes for news, they might kind of pay for utility or for bespokeness or some kind of facility. Paying for the actual piece of content itself, I just don't see it. And what's more, I'm not sure how desirable it is.
I'm glad to hear that your mind is still open, Emily.
Yes, I'm well known as a ditherer in The Guardian.
J.D. Lasker.
You know, when Emily says that nothing has really changed in the past 3 years, something has changed. Well, first, on the traditional media side, nothing has changed, because I can tell you those discussions are still taking place in those forums where newspaper executives are trying to decide, okay, you know, if I charge a subscription fee, how many people are going to sign up? And, you know, the answer is always, you know, hardly any. But on the other side, social media has happened in the past 3 years, and that has really changed the game, I think, in some fundamental ways. It's entirely possible that Kevin Anderson of The Guardian, sitting in the front row here, will be working for Twitter in 5 years instead of The Guardian.
I thought he was already.
News to us that he's not.
You know, because there has been a fundamental change of how people are getting their information. They're going to their trusted networks of friends and associates on social networks like Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, Facebook has become a news organization in a way. It's all personalized news streams now of the attention that you want to pay to certain kinds of people, organizations, news organizations. And I'm afraid that news organizations are not very high up on that list right now.
Robert, you wanted to get in.
We might pay for a luxury good. I buy the New Yorker, right? Because I want, you know, my wife and I both read that, but we like showing off to our friends that we're the New Yorker, you know, and it's a thing that sits on our coffee table. It's a luxury good that sticks around. It's not a newspaper that we're just going to shove
but
off.
But also, you're not, when you buy the New Yorker, you're kind of not even, you're not paying for the content, because what you pay doesn't really cover the price of the paper. You know, so again, it kind of, you pay for the facility, you pay for the delivery mechanism.
A lot of papers, the cost of subscription only pays for the paper actually physically getting. Subscriptions were never really a profit center for old media. It was all advertising. And so if we're going online and it's, no one has to deliver it to my house, why should I pay for it?
What about all this talk, Sarah Lacey, about newspapers and this? Being talked about in the United States, getting together, and if they all charged, then that would be fine, wouldn't it?
It's just stupid. I mean, like, the newspapers need, and it's the same thing as their whole like war on Google. And frankly, I know you said this earlier, somewhat tongue in cheek, but even blaming Craigslist. I mean, if newspapers were, it starts with subscribers. If they were providing what people wanted, and the audience wasn't fleeing to all these other things, they would not be having the advertiser problem.
What about all this as well as talking about charging, there's all this talk actually in the last couple of weeks, a lot of it coming out of the United States, about copyright, and perhaps links should be copyrighted, and that. Will you explain
sad.
That for listeners?
It's like
can
a
you explain
dinosaur
where,
limping
where that came
along,
from?
And it, the glacier's coming, and it's like, he's like, well, maybe I'll hang out with my other dinosaurs and ignore this glacier and it'll go away. I mean, it is just ridiculous. I mean, last I checked, they actually could change their sites so Google couldn't spider them, and they couldn't send them a bunch of traffic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's they've done everything they can to show up as high as possible. They've put dig buttons all over everything. They have everyone tweeting. These media organizations have worked so hard to have this content disseminated everywhere, to now step back and cry foul and say somehow that's stealing their content and hurting their businesses when it's a game they have, you know, they've played, is ridiculous.
Emily.
I think, and actually just going back to what JD said, which is absolutely right about social media changing the game, of course what's actually provoked this kind of panic at the moment is the fact that the advertising rules have changed as well, which is just that, you know, the network sale, etc., means that, you know, kind of that suddenly the idea that display advertising might work against a kind of a website model has seemingly evaporated. But the answer to that does not to me seem to be to retreat back to something. So you know, what I'm interested in is actually the lack of innovation, or not the lack of visible innovation around particularly kind of, you know, agency client kind of media relationships, which again just seems to be at the moment stuck in an echo chamber of, we talk to your kind of completely unsuitable business about how we can sustain a business on the back of this, and we all, you know, everybody kind of knows that it's doomed. It's just we can't get to the point where we say, well, let's do something else instead.
JD, you wanted to get in.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll take one last shot at newspaper, old media, and that is, you know, it's like shooting dinosaurs in a barrel. I mean, these they are not progressing. I think this is going to be one of the big problems of journalism moving forward. Having worked in newspapers for as long as I have, and I still have a lot of friends in the craft, so I know that things have not changed very much in terms of newspaper culture. You know, we all come from Silicon Valley. We're all into the mantra, you know, fail, 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 fail fast, and then move on to the next thing. And that is totally alien to corporate America. I don't know what the situation here is in the UK, but I imagine it's fairly similar. So there needs to be a new kind of approach. And there has to be, you know, a willingness to experiment, to try new things, to move on, to innovate. One of the things that I've been proposing lately is that newspapers ought to be opening up their sites to become like a community platform to encourage, you know, people in the community who are like techies to write code for them, to open up APIs, you know, not getting too techie, that's another buzzword, but to...
Well, we didn't promise acronyms.
Let the community, you know, do some of the heavy lifting for you. You know, it's not going to be a world anymore where you just have this cadre of highly trained professionals who are going out to cover a community and people are going to pay for it. So there's a great decoupling going on. Mm. And I think we just need to say that we have to find a way for journalism to exist and to succeed, and for people who are doing important journalism, investigative journalism, in-depth journalism, community journalism, to find a way to get paid, because the community ain't going to do it. It's, you know, journalism is hard work, and, you know, nobody wants to spend their time on their Saturdays digging into corporate records or public records for hours on end.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure there are a few people.
Well, a few crazy
quite enjoy
there.
That.
Come upstairs. We can introduce you to a few.
All right. We've talked enough, I think, amongst ourselves. It's probably high time we opened this up to the floor. Now, I think we should probably go to Craig Newmark first. Should we have a go at Craig Newmark?
There he is.
There is he is.
Get him!
Can you just hang on till we get the microphone to you, Craig Newmark? You must be absolutely fed up to the back teeth of this question, but it is all your fault, isn't it? you're being blamed for everything from the death of the newspaper advertising model to the downturn in the moral certitude of the United States, aren't you?
No one serious is blaming us for those things. I've spoken with a lot of publishers and editors over the years. Newspapers, the decline has a lot of causes. In the U.S., I'm mostly concerned with the entirety of the trust issue. Yeah, the idea is, what can you read that you can actually believe? As you've brought up yourselves, sometimes we rely more on our network of friends than we do with conventional media. That's more true of the young, and I'm terribly far from being young. By the way, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Did you
expect better treatment from a DCI Gene Hunt?
Did you? I'm no DCI Gene Hunt. Did you ever expect when you started Craigslist that it would lead to what it's led to? That it would have the, you know, changing effect that it has had?
I had no expectations, or for that matter, vision. Just started something very simple and committed and followed through with that. It is, in a sense, that simple. fortunately, in 2000, I was able to find someone much better at managing than I am, Jim Buckmaster, considering that my management skills are, generously speaking, limited.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Could I have a comfy chair?
Now, there's been plenty of questions on Twitter, because you can anonymously do it here. I want you to open up and be yourselves and not hide behind the anonymity of Twitter. So come on. Yes, in the middle.
I'm Angus Barker. I'm a video journalist. And there's been a lot of discussion about the APIs and opening up data and things like that. I'm quite interested to know how the Guardian's work is going.
Yeah, well, Emily, the Guardian...
I'm very open about
that. Why don't you just explain to people who are listening who may still not know what the API is and what...
We haven't bored them with the... openness of our... I mean, the idea with an API is that you essentially open the guts of what you do and all the data that you have within the Guardian's publishing domain so that people with developer skills can have a look at it. We sort of issue these things called keys, and they can use the API to have a look at what we've got and then to create other stuff out the back of it. So we've had some fantastic kind of maps of and graphs of how much swearing there has been in The Guardian over the last 5 years. I mean, the important thing to say about Open Platform, which is Matt McAllister's project who came here from Yahoo, and it's been an incredibly exciting thing for us to do, is almost the effect it has, I think, psychologically on the organisation is at the moment as important as the output from it, because to have some of the world's most talented developers quite interested in what we do, I think is really helpful, because actually without their accumulated knowledge, I don't think we're ever going to make any progress on things like commercial models, because actually kind of we're much more likely to find it in that area than anywhere else. I think journalistically it stops people being scared that by opening up and letting go of control can actually be a creative thing. We've had we've had about 1,000 applications for keys, and we're beginning to see if you go to Anthony Gormley, actually, if you go to the Cass Foundation Sculpture site, you'll see that kind of against all their kind of sculptors, they've taken the API and they've taken all our sort of stuff about people like Anthony Gormley and they've rendered it on the front of their site. There's been a football site that's done a similar thing. And of course, the first thing is you show this to kind of journalists and they go, oh my God, you've given away our content. And then you go, no, hang on a second, we're actually kind of populating this with our brand. And we can now have a conversation with these people about whether or not it's working for them, about whether or not it drives traffic back to us, about whether or not there is a kind of a payment model within some of that. So I think it's been been phenomenally internally powerful here in terms of allowing us to start conversations about a whole load of things that we could have spent months that we don't have arguing about. So from that point of view, I think it's been incredibly, incredibly helpful and refreshing and exciting.
It's interesting you say that months that we don't have. No, not years or...
Yeah, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, does it? I think that kind of this is a chronically awful recession, and actually we do have months because we are, like Rory, slightly funded in a slightly different way, and we have, we've a trust status, and we don't have shareholders beating down the door. But every media business in the world, or certainly kind of in the US and the UK at the moment, and most other parts of the world, will be finding that its costs are outweighing its revenues. So from that point of view, the sooner you can kind of put a stop to that, the better. As I say, it moves the conversation.
One quick thing to add to that, and that is that the only reason I think that Twitter has taken the world by storm over the past 6-12 months is because they have an open API. They had no idea that there would be this enormous outburst of creativity on the part of independent developers that don't work for them but are latching on to this platform to build really cool stuff. And, I think a year from now we're going to be astonished at some of the things that are coming out.
So will they have found a business model by then?
I have a lot of faith in Twitter, and you know there are lots of ways they can hook into it. But right now they just want to keep growing and growing.
That's another key point for us, which is it's not just about stuff that we can create or developers can create for us. It's actually who we can work with. So for instance, you know, we went into Google the other day, and they showed us something, and they said this is actually there are not many publishers we can work with on this because most publishers' CMSs are not configured in the way that yours are, and most publishers don't have an open API, but we can kind of have a look and we can go. So, you know, it's a business advantage for us. It absolutely is, I think.
Yes, at the back.
Hi, I'm Susan Bratton with Personal Life Media and one of the Traveling Geeks. And there was some conversation of a lack of innovation in advertising and sponsorship support. What would you like?
Sarah Lacey.
It's like porn. I can't tell you, but I'll know it when I see it.
Well, what a fantastic last answer. I think we'll leave all that there. I'll say
one thing about that. We don't want, you know, I think interruption marketing, interruption advertising is going to be gone, you know, in 10 years. And, you know, you've got to find new models to make advertising that's personalized, customizable, relevant to me, something that's welcome, that's useful, that I find, you know, something that I want on my screen, that, you know, people offer me services, people who know something about me that can, you know, offer me a bargain or an opportunity to connect with them in some way. So, you know, so advertising needs to become more social too, I think.
All right. Should we have one last question to each member of the panel? Same question for all of you. Should it matter that maybe there won't be a paper version of The Guardian? Emily Bell.
No. It doesn't matter. No. Alan Rossbridge, the big boss, he said 10 years ago, one day, the next set of presses we buy will be the last set of presses. I kind of think that there will be paper versions of papers, but not of every paper. And, you know, The Guardian is a set of values and an ethos and an approach to journalism and hopefully an approach to community, which ought to translate into technology and discussion and news provision and comment and analysis online. And I think we do it quite well.
Rory.
Can you keep it going just for a few more years? I've got an 18-year-old, and the only paper product he consumes is he comes down in the morning and takes The Guardian off me. He doesn't want the Financial Times. But he consumes a couple of pages of The Guardian. And
Which ones is it?
He starts at the front, amazingly.
Fantastic.
J.D. Lasker.
Bring him in.
Well, two things. One is I'm an avid newspaper reader. I get two Sunday newspapers, the Sunday New York Times, the Mercury News. I will be very sad on the day that the Mercury News folds its newspaper, which I think it will within 5 to 6, 7 years. I hope the New York Times goes on, if not sooner. The New York Times, I hope it goes on for a lot longer. I think it matters to the extent that journalism needs a business model to support it, because people are not going to pay, you know, in micropayments or donations or tip jars for investigative reporting, for in-depth journalism, for any of this stuff. It's always been a cost center, not a revenue center.
Sarah Lacey.
Close all the presses. Shut them down now. Let's just get it over with. I mean, honestly, I think there's no value in
Let's not drag it out for years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, seriously, we've already been dragging it out this long. Let's shut it down. Let's move everything online and, force figuring out the next model rather than just, you know, letting it dwindle and dwindle and slowly die.
Robert Scoble.
It won't matter, but it won't matter to me as a news consumer. I'm going to get my news. It does matter for the business because paper was a distribution vehicle. And because all of that news got distributed all at one time, I think it brought multiple sides to a story. Right now, we can pay attention to just TMZ if we want to. And that means we're not getting a whole range of news that we should be paying attention to. The friction that we've been feeling for 9 years between, you know, professional journalism and amateur journalism is that the old journalists didn't have to worry about that. They didn't have to worry about how their news or their words were going to be, or their TV or their radio was going to get heard by people. If you're online,
time, you really have to work at getting distribution and getting people to pay attention to you. And that's a different skill than a lot of old school journalists have.
How is it different going to the Guardian site and getting that same collection of news and information and physically getting
it? Because people don't go to sites anymore. And we've already been through this. We hang out on Facebook or Twitter. But that's the way we get our information is changing, and that's causing friction. It causes people to get a little angry because they have to learn new skills. They have to do things to get attention. TechCrunch got popular because he had an image on every story. I remember how he beat everybody. Today, he's doing video where other people aren't doing video on stories. And that's a skill that you need and equipment and, you know, understanding.
And
that
a mindset.
And a mindset that old school journalists didn't have to deal with when they were writing for The Guardian.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Perhaps we should just go back to the screen that's actually behind us here for one last comment, which is that newspapers have been, these are comments, I should say, to the listeners that are being twittered by the audience here. Newspapers have been communicating in 140 characters or less for hundreds of years. They're called headlines. I think that should be 140 characters or fewer. You need an editor. And we've also had a request, Emily, for
by the way, less is better because it uses fewer characters.
Yeah. Touché. We've also had a request. That there's somebody here who's going to be very disappointed, Emily Bell, if you don't go away without issuing our favourite catchphrase.
Actually, I have tweeted this already, but you may have missed it, which is of course, we haven't talked about it, but there is, of course, the death of linear television to
Excellent.
Be discussed.
We'll save that for another podcast.
I feel like a kind of one of those kind of like adult sort of talking sex books people, as far as like porn.
on that, that's twice we've mentioned porn tonight.
It's a new business model.
Yes.
It's going to appear in iTunes with porn next to it. Some very disappointed people out there, unless they like hard drives.
On that note, I think it's really time to draw the evening to a close. Head to the bar. My thanks to our travelling geeks, Sarah Lacey, J.D. Lassica and Robert Scoble, to the BBC's Rory Ketlin-Jones, and of course the one and only Emily Bell. If you've been listening at home, post your comments on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. We've put links actually to all our contributors' sites on there too. Thanks to all the members of the Guardian audio team who've helped with our first live show. Our producer is Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells, and thank you all for coming.